Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello and welcome to episode number 115 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. I hope you're all fine and dandy. First of all, as ever, I'd like to say a big hello and thank you to our Patreon supporters, without whom we wouldn't be able to produce these podcasts. And if you'd like to support for as little as £3 a month, you can do so by following the link in the Ministry of Arts Instagram feed. If you're not able, that's fine. The content is free here for everyone. Today, I'll be speaking to painter Geoffrey Harrison. Geoffrey and I got introduced to each other by a mutual friend. And when I went over to his Instagram feed to have a little nose at his work, a great big smile came upon my face. He's got the most joyous Instagram feed. So after chatting for a little while on Instagram, I asked him if he'd come on the podcast. And when we did get to record, we was chatting for ages. And normally when I do these podcasts, over Zoom that is, we have a little chat for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes beforehand, and the same at the end, and obviously record the podcast in the middle. And so interesting and outright relevant was the issues that Geoffrey was talking about. I kept most of the conversations before and after in this podcast. Hence, it's two episodes long, each being about 45 minutes. For the first 10 minutes or so of this podcast, Geoffrey was telling me about his day job, where he works behind the scenes at a Samaritan's centre in London. And I think so important are the Samaritans at a time like this, when we're not really in control of our own lives. I thought to myself, well, if this 10 or 15 minute conversation that Geoffrey or I are having about the Samaritans could resonate with someone who's, you know, who's not in the best place at the moment, you know, it could be the difference between, well, them making a phone call or not. So I asked Geoff if it was okay for me to keep it in. But away from Geoff's day job, talking about his art, I think this episode is going to be one of the favourites of many people. Because in this episode, Geoff speaks about many of the hurdles he's had to cross within his practice. And many of them he's still trying to get over, you know. We were speaking about the things that we just wish they would have taught us in art school. We speak about the pros and cons of social media. Or rather, our likes and dislikes of social media. We speak about so many topics, it's definitely going to be one of those where you sit there nodding or even answering the podcast as you're listening to it, you know. So if you listen to these podcasts the day that they come out, this episode is coming out on Monday the 10th of May. The second episode is coming out 2 days later on Wednesday the 12th. So just before I introduce you to Geoff, let me just tell you a little something about him. After completing an undergraduate degree in fine art printing from the School of Art in Hull, he lived in Japan for several years. After returning to the UK to complete an MA in London, Geoffrey now lives and works in London, where he was an artist in residence at Bart's Pathology Museum at St Bart's Hospital, and recently completed a residency at the Royal Veterinary College, He has a studio in Bermondsey and exhibits in the UK and internationally. His practice is often collaborative and in partnership with other individuals, organisations and institutions, teaching, facilitating workshops, presenting seminars and talks, and curating work by other artists. So, that out of the way, come and listen to the man himself, Geoffrey Harrison, as him and I had a great chat over Zoom.
Yeah, all's good. I'm on holiday. I've got a week off from work. So I've spent the whole week. Well, you know, you have this plan to spend the whole week doing art. If you're the same as me, you know, you get this time off. And actually, I spent quite a lot of it drinking and going out and seeing mates and things like that. So yeah. I've done
every
work.
Excuse I have, not to.
Yeah, exactly.
What is it you do?
For my day job, I work at Samaritans in Soho. I'm the centre manager, so I look after all the building and the staff team that we've got there and that sort of stuff. But I don't do anything. I don't work on the phones or anything like that.
No. How are the guys who work on the phones? I've got a friend of mine, his mum works on it, and she's done it for years and years. But I can imagine it being quite traumatic for some people, some of the calls that they may receive.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the volunteers who do it, they go into it knowing to some extent what they're going to get. So they tend to be quite resilient people, with some experience of some sort of trauma in their lives anyway, which might be the reason why they become a volunteer. But yeah, it can be quite a burden. You know, if you take a call that's quite traumatic, it can be quite a big burden for them. But they have lots of processes. I mean, it's been going for nearly 70 years now, and they've got a lot of ways of dealing with those things. So they've got a lot of debriefing processes that they have. I mean, I don't do it, so I'm not that familiar with how you manage those kind of, you know, because you're not a participant in the life of the person, you're just a sort of sounding board for their experiences. So, but yeah. I mean, particularly at the moment, people are feeling, maybe at the moment, things are in a bit of flux, aren't they? Because people are starting to come out and go shopping and do normal life things. But for the last year, things have, you know, people have been finding it really tough, haven't they?
Had you noticed that the calls went up significantly in the last year?
Well, I don't get a view of that. That's all looked after at the central charity. They do have those stats, and but in our branch, it's quite hard to. Even though we're the biggest branch with the most volunteers on at any one time, it's difficult to see a higher volume because the volunteers, they come in, they make themselves available to take a call, and a call comes through. And usually what they do anyway is if it's a busy time of day, the calls are kind of back to back anyway. Yeah. So you don't get a sense of the people who aren't getting through. There is like a kind of dashboard that you can look at, and it shows you nationally how many volunteers are available, how many calls are waiting to be answered, to give them a sense of, you know, that their work is meaningful, you know, they're picking up the call.
Is that how you know Jason?
Yeah, it is actually. Yeah. And it was Jason who put me onto your podcast and your Instagram.
Jason does the listener thing in prisons, doesn't he?
That's right. Yeah.
And they were a vital link in there. My friend was one while I was in there, and you know, as I'm sure you're aware, I was in there for quite some time. But my mate Graham was a listener, and yeah, he'd get a tap on the door at like 4 o'clock in the morning to say there's a con somewhere in the jail that sort of needs someone to speak to, you know.
Have you read that book by I can't remember the name of the guy? It's called A Bit of a Stretch.
No, but I was speaking to him just the other day.
Yeah, because he's been a listener at prison as well.
Yeah,
when he was in Wandsworth, I think. Yeah, I think he'd been. Yeah, I really enjoyed his book. I don't actually. When I say I read books, I don't really read books. I do audio books.
Oh, of course. I, that's the only way I do them.
I've never been much of a big reader, but I like watching movies and stuff, but when I'm painting, having audiobooks on is brilliant. But I always say that I've read them, but I always think that I'm slightly cheating because I'm not doing the physical reading bit.
Somebody reading stone, Jeff. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? Getting two jobs done at once. That's how when I was in jail and I was spending so much time painting and drawing and learning pretty much. But I was sort of hooked on the stories as well, the books. So that's what I'd do. I'd have them in the background. And I found it easier to have this narrative going on in the background and follow the story while I was painting. But I couldn't do it with music because I'd start singing along and going somewhere else with the music.
Oh, okay.
So for some reason, the stories, and that was the same as how I got into podcasts. Because I could work and have this story going on in the background. The podcasts I listen to are mainly interview type, you know, and I would still listen to the conversation whilst painting, but music used to, I couldn't work with the two running parallel, you know.
That's interesting. I used to put, when I was younger, I used to listen to, was it Jazz FM?
Yeah, I was listening to it just the other day. It's still
going. Yeah, I don't know why I used to like that, but because I didn't know anything about jazz, and I didn't especially like it, but it was like something in the background. It might as well have been classical music or something like that. As long as you were saying, as long as it wasn't music that I knew, or pop music that I could sing along to. Yeah. So when I'm, because I've seen some of your work where you're doing the hatching, the tally thing, you can get into a zone of doing that kind of thing. And if you're listening to something like a podcast or something like that, I don't know if you can finish one in a day, but if you go back to it the next day or another time and you pick up where you left off and you look at some of the marks you made, you can remember what you were listening to at the point where you made that mark. And I'm looking at my paintings going, well, I remember painting that little hair and I can remember who I was listening to when I did that. It's really weird that memory is amazing, isn't it? A thing like that you can bring back those funny little moments, the meaningless moments really in a memory of a story, but they're all in there.
Yeah. Anyway, I suppose that's a good point to start talking about your artwork. As you can see, we've been recording for a little while. Are you all right for the Samaritan stuff to stay in? At times like this, that's a nice little thing to keep in, I think, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. I don't think I've said anything that's especially problematic or revealing there. Have you got still something to do with the Kursler Trust then?
I'm on the board for it now.
Oh, are you?
I'm a board member. Yeah, I got invited late 2019, I think it was. Every year when the show's on, it's on for eight to 10 weeks. And I'd go there several times while the show was on because there would be ex-cons being the invigilators. So I'd go down to even when I had nothing to do with the charity, I'd go down to chat with them. And you can also write little feedback forms for the entrance. And I would always go down there 3, 4, 5 times just so I made sure that I wrote to every entrant. But just knowing that there was someone outside looking at your work, it felt really good. And I was I'm quite sure that it must be a real lift if you actually get something physical from a person to say, I was looking at your work and I really liked it and it made me think of whatever, you know, I'm sure it would give someone quite a lift and it could easily be a turning point for someone, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and because that sort of thing was for me. So, you know, I figure if I write it to 200 people, if it resonates with 1, 2, 3 people, you know, job done.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I like that. I like that idea of making sure that you're covering every single one of them. Yeah. You don't want to miss that. Even if it doesn't come to anything, but if one of them does, like you say, come to a turning point, I think those are transformative things, aren't they? So
again, before I got involved with Kursler, I'd go and do prison art workshops. I'd done one in a youth prison. And about 2 years later, I got an email out of the blue from this guy who he never got involved in the arts, but he mentioned that I'd gone in to give this workshop, like our conversation was the sort of catalyst that made him want to go to college. And, you know, he went on to do a plumbing course.
Yeah. Do you, so I went to, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I went to HMP Grendon. Do you know about Grendon?
I was next to it in the little open one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. So, you know what Grendon's philosophy is about, you know, prisoner-led structure of the day and that kind of thing.
That's it.
And there was a... Sorry, mate. What?
Art therapy is strong in there, isn't it?
It is really strong. Yeah, I was really impressed.
I mean, it is for violent, mainly violent and sexual offences, isn't it?
Yeah, for people, I think they're coming towards the end of their sentence, and but they've got to have, I think they've got to have at least 18 months or maybe 24 months remaining.
Yeah,
and they've got to, you know, gone through a series of, I suppose, good behaviour.
Yeah.
Previously before they can go there. But yeah, it's a sort of a therapy process, isn't it?
How did you find the experience of going into Grendon?
I'd never been inside a prison before. And I know that it probably wasn't a very good idea about all prisons, you know, because I know there's a difference in different categories. And then the experience of the physical experience of going through the entrance and things would be different depending on category. But I mean, there I found it very different from what I expected. Because I was there to look at the artwork that the prisoners had made as well. It was to do with a project that was, there was an artist in residence who'd been there working with the prisoners for a couple of years. And we were looking at how he'd been able to sort of stimulate and look at the relationship that he had with the prisoners. And it was a really warm relationship. And I just kind of forgot that it was an all male environment. I just completely forgot that. Yeah. You know, and thinking about, it's obvious when you think about prisons, okay, so there's men's prisons and women's prisons. And I, you know, but not getting into the further subdivisions of gender and things like that. But broadly speaking, you've got men's prisons and women's prisons. To walk into a completely male environment, I found quite unusual. But it certainly wasn't unwelcoming. All the inmates that I met there were really engaging. They wanted to talk about their work. They were really proud of their work. And there was a massive range, you know, I've listened to when you've been talking to other people and you've been talking about your art experience starting at when you're in prison, about how your work was, it sounds almost immediately, was in that fine art context. A lot of the work that I was seeing there did fit into that context, but a lot of it was also craft, if I could separate those two things out. And I found that really interesting as well. There was this just a continuum of craft all the way through to what I would call sort of conceptual fine art. And there was no difference. You know, they weren't split into different ends of the room. It was all together. It was all mixed up together. And I really, really liked that.
Because there's normally a theme, an unwritten or an unspoken theme, because it's everyone's sharing that same experience. It's like when you go to the Kursler, I don't know if you've ever been to their exhibition. You know, I invite other artists to go to the Kursler show just to feel the power. It's almost sort of primal, some of the artworks in there, you know, the feeling that you get from them.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. Yeah, I mean, I definitely found it. And also the interesting experience for me was going and looking at the artwork. And there's the guy who's made it. He's sort of loitering in the background, talking to his mate. And he's really interested in what you're looking at and what you're going to say and things. But that meant that those conversations were really easy, you know, because everybody wanted to talk. So I wanted to talk to the artists about their work. And the guys were really keen to just hear what other people had to say about stuff.
Yeah,
I found that really interesting, really, really interesting experience.
And they want a little bit of acceptance. You know, that's all they want, to be told that they're good at something. That's that's how I felt anyway.
You know,
I've discovered this thing that I didn't know about, and then I fell in love with, and then I was sort of addicted to, more or less, or obsessed with. And then, you know, I mean, the first outsider that I had any dealings with was the assessor from the local college who came in to assess the work that I'd done for that course. I just so wanted a bit of acceptance, or, you know, anything to say, yeah, you're all right at this. So you do feel a little bit downbeat. And then when you've got someone telling there's something positive about you, you know, it's magnified so much, you know.
But I guess that's an insecurity of artists anyway, isn't it? That,
definitely.
For me at least anyway, is like I constantly need some sort of endorsement. And that's why, you know, Instagram, which I know you're on, and I know a lot of artists like very much, and I like it because it's a great way of seeing other work.
Yeah.
And almost like a benchmarking about the kind of thing you're doing. What are other people doing in this sort of niche field? But also, I need quite a lot of feedback about my work. I'm not a very insecure person, but when it comes to my artwork, I'm doing it and it's visual, and I'm not just doing it for myself. You know, I'm making a visual thing to show to other people.
Yeah.
And I kind of want people to tell me whether they think it's good or bad.
Am I doing this for any reason? You know, or am I doing this for no reason whatsoever?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're doing it in a vacuum. It's just the therapy. But if you're doing it and you want other people to see it, then you've got an audience.
Yeah.
And I kind of want them to either cheer or boo.
Either way, yeah.
But nobody does it. Nobody says negative things unless you're at art college, where basically you're just constantly dodging negative comments.
On the opposite, Jeff, I almost search for the people who will give me an honest bit of crit about my work, because, you know, I wouldn't have made it if I thought it was bad. Most of what I make, it connects with me, with what I'm trying to achieve.
Mm.
I know that I'm not 100%, and I want the person to go, that bit ain't right. You know, like my friend Lee, who I speak about often in the podcast, he would just say to me, it's not quite working. What you're saying and what I'm seeing isn't quite 100%. And this is what I'm feeling isn't working. And he's right most of the time, you know. It's only going to improve your practice.
Yeah, I think it's good to have that. It's definitely good to have it. I think my experience of art school was that it was pretty much exclusively, that's a bit shit.
Yeah. Where did you go?
I went to, I shouldn't say now, because now I've said that they just told me it was shit all the time.
It was back in the day.
Yeah, it was back in the day. It was in the 90s. I went to art school in Hull. Oh, Hull, yes. School of Art, which was, it was part of the, I think it was the University of Humberside at the time, but it had this amazing, huge printmaking department. And I actually applied to be a painter, and I didn't get into any of my first choice universities. But in those days, you didn't apply like you applied to normal university. You had to apply in a separate way. Anyway, I can't remember, but I think you put down three universities, a first choice, second choice, and a third choice.
Yeah.
And if you didn't get any first, you went to, maybe it's the same.
That was the same as what I'd done, although mine was 2000. I mean, we've hardly, you know, we've been speaking for half an hour. We've hardly touched on your practice at all.
But I have a tendency to waffle.
I'm fine with that. You know, if you've listened to any of my podcasts, you can see that, you know, I'm quite all right with that. How would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
Yeah, do you know what? I've heard you ask all these questions, and I always forget. I always think, right, I better write that down, because Gary's going to ask me exactly the same question. I'm never prepared for it. I would say it's quite easy, actually, because there's always two ways of this, but like, or more than two. But like, most people would be able to get what I do, because visually it's quite readable. It's figurative painting, and I quite like to paint things. I don't want to. I'm not interested in doing kind of photographic realistic paintings, and I don't find any energy in that slavish sort of copying thing. But what I end up with, the boards or the panels or the canvases, and sometimes other things like videos and stuff that I make, I want them to be, to have a visual language that anybody can access.
Yeah.
Right. So certainly not abstract. They're what I would call sort of a fairly accurate graphic representation of a reality. I like drawing, and I draftsmanship for me is a really important part of my work. So I always want them to look good. You know, and good is a funny word, isn't it, in art? But I kind of want them to look the way I want them to look. And sometimes that means they're quite unfinished because I got it and I want to preserve that with a rough mark. But a lot of the time I get the tiny brush out and I get really close and I've got a magnifying glass and I've knackered my eyes from doing this. So I now wear glasses when I paint. So the first thing is it's really visual and it's really readable, I think. But there's the other way of reading it, which is I include tons of references in my artwork, and it's all maybe mannered, but like what I mean is like very deliberate and very conscious of the things I'm putting in there. So lots of painters who paint maybe include stuff that they're unaware of and that maybe they only come to understand, you know, 10 years later when they go back and they look at their work and they go, oh my God, you know, I did that because I was going through that difficult time or because, you know, I was obsessed with something and it comes through in your work. For me, actually, there may be a bit of that, but a lot of what I put in there is quite conscious, deliberate, codified. So at the moment I'm doing is self-portrait. I do a lot of self-portraits because I'm a bit self-obsessed. But actually it's mostly because I can use myself as a mechanism for conveying something about what I'm interested in. And what I'm interested in mostly is like ideas about masculinity, manliness, some of those tropes that we get, which is why I'm interested in, you know, why people are in prison or what happens to men when they're in prison, particularly men. I mean, it's interesting what happens to everybody, of course, but I'm interested in that kind of masculinity. So for me, putting into my paintings little symbols. So I don't know, I've got some duct tape in one painting that I've got on at the moment. It has lots of connotations, duct tape. It's it could be quite sinister, actually. I've only just thought about it. In the context of prison, duct tape could be quite a, you know, a sort of across the mouth, especially in films and things. Do you know, in film, when they tear off the duct tape, can you imagine doing that with a beard?
And it's a big gap, like when you see the people having their chest done. Could you imagine pulling it off and there's a big square of skin?
It'd bleed and everything. It'd be horrible.
Say that about duct tape, Jeff. I don't know if you've heard me talk about this, but I was doing a project quite a few years ago now, 2012, and it was called Walk a Mile. Like, do a call out for people to send me a pair of shoes and a problem or something they've been carrying around internally for some time. And you know that a problem aired is a problem halved.
It
was based on the proverb, never judge a man till you walk a mile in his shoes.
Yeah.
So you'd send me a pair of shoes and your problem, this weight you've been, you know, carrying around, then I would walk a mile in someone's shoes and then I would read, then afterwards I would read their problem or their, you know, their weight, as it were. And then within the realms of this concept, no one else can judge you apart from me, and I'm not going to do that. Or if I do, it'll only be internally. It was a beautiful little thing. Obviously, it'd be women posting stuff as well. So even if I had a pair of size 5 high heel shoes, I would wear them. I'd fuck my feet up doing it, you know, with blisters and whatnot, and, you know, sprained ankles where I'm, you know, I'm not as good as I used to be walking on a pair of high heels. Put on a bit of lumber. I'd get gaffer tape. So what I'd do, I'd walk the mile with gaffer tape around my feet and these high heels. Then I'd document it when I got back to my flat by taking a photograph of these high heels or these shoes, gaffer tape to my feet. And then I'd cut the gaffer tape off with a Stanley knife. Anyway. I used to work doing a night job and I'd get home at like 4 in the morning, which is an ideal time to walk around a council estate with my heels on, right?
Yeah, and gaffer tape.
Exactly. So that's when I used to do it. So I've taken a photograph of these shoes and it's still pretty dark, you know. Well, all of a sudden, a fucking police car has come into the car park where I am. These two coppers have got out, and by this time, I've taken the shoes off, put them in the carrier bag, and he went, "Why did you just take a photograph of us?" And I went, "To be honest, mate," I said, "I never even saw you." I said, "I was taking a photograph of something else," and this was before I was. It was with a camera as well, not with my
phone. Yeah, proper camera.
So he went, "So what was you taking a photograph of then?" And then I've just laughed. And he said, "What's so funny?" And I've looked in my bag. I've got a fucking camera, a roll of gaffer tape, a Stanley knife, and a fucking pair of high heel shoes. And I'm fucking only a few years out of being, you know, coming out of a fucking 14-year prison sentence. I can see this being a fucking an arrest, you know what I mean? While they look for the body. And the thing was, I used to walk half a mile one way and half a mile back. And the half a mile I'd just walked, we've got a lake half a mile from where my flat was. So my walk was to the lake and back. And I've got to try and say this without looking like a crazy fucking kidnapper, you know what I mean? And they weren't having any of it. And the more I was laughing, the more it was winding them up. And I just started it, and I'd just gone onto Twitter. And I went, "Are any of yous on Twitter?" And I never even had my phone on me, because there was no reason for it, you know?
No.
I went, "Are any of yous on Twitter?" And they went, "No." And I was like, "Oh, fuck, this is just getting worse and worse, you know?" And, in the end, when I go up to my flat, we had this cupboard outside, which is where I used to keep all of the shoes that I used to get.
Yeah. Which,
and as I went up there, I had my door key and the key for this cupboard. And I've opened this cupboard and I went, "Look, here's all the shoes I was talking about," which now made me look like a fucking
serial. Even worse. Yeah.
It was just getting worse and worse. But I think, well, in the end, it was getting so, I was laughing at it so much that they could see that I weren't, you know, I was a master actor if I was covering up.
Yeah, myself. Yeah.
But it was getting fucking comical in the end. Yeah, it was scary.
Well, I'll never look at the gaffer tape in the same way again.
Yeah, so it depends on where you're looking at it from.
It does.
Different connotations. Sorry about going off.
No, well, that's quite nice, because, you know, I'm those interpretations of stuff that I chuck in these paintings, they're not unwelcome. Like, I'd be really surprised sometimes if people get what it is that I'm painting those things for. You know, for me, the gaffer tape is just one of a bunch of things that I've got around my studio. I don't know what the difference between gaffer tape and duct tape. I think they're the same thing.
One's a brand.
Oh, okay. So all the other stuff that's in this painting, they're all things from around the studio, but they all have a function. And for the gaffer tape, it's a method of repair. That's all it is for me in this. It's also quite nice, because this one's a sort of silvery one, so it's got a nice shine to it, and it's got a nice texture where it's been torn off and things. So I'm enjoying painting that, but it's, for me, it's about repair, and making things work again, you know. So funny you should say about shoes, because when I was looking at gaffer tape, I remember I used to live in Japan, and when I was teaching English there, and I saw these guys in a park in Tokyo. I wasn't living in Tokyo, but I was there on like a trip. And there were these guys, and they do rockabilly dancing in a park. And it's brilliant. They're amazing. They're all these guys, they're different ages, from teenagers up to their 50s and 60s, all dressed in their tight black jeans and winkle pickers and leather jackets and these quiffs. And I've always wanted, if I had hair, which it is part of my work now, you know, about this thing that mostly only men have this experience of baldness. So it's quite a useful trope for man is bald head and beard. But I would like hair just so that I could have an amazing quiff with a big duck's ass on the back. I think they look brilliant. So these Japanese guys all doing this rockabilly dancing, and their winkle pickers are getting all scuffed up from all the dancing they do, going onto their tiptoes and onto the sides of their feet. And so they're all bound up with duct tape. Brilliant. And it's almost like a kind of a badge of honor, I think, that you've decked in your winkle pickers to such an extent that you've got to hold them together with tape. So there's a kind of thing there about, I don't know, honour in worn out things.
Yeah, you know, and those with the most duct tape have obviously got the have been doing it for longer, you know, have got the more experience.
Yeah, exactly. So the more sort of frayed and worn things are, the higher status they are. I kind of like that idea. There's something in there.
I mean, you're saying about you know, the drawing of yourself and men with bald head and beards.
Yeah.
When I first saw your Instagram feed, it's one of the few where I just sort of literally laughed out loud and went, oh, brilliant. It's Baldy Beardo.
Yeah.
And I just saw all of these different images and drawings of guys with bald head and beard. And I thought it was a perfect, I even sent it to a few people going, here, look at this. How cool is this? And just seeing these, like these images in different angles, bald head and beard. Brilliant. It was really refreshing to see.
Oh, I'm glad you liked that. And I'm glad it felt fun and refreshing, because when I started doing those, I can't remember the thought process, but it was probably because I was a bit tired of drawing myself a lot. And I got a mirror, draw myself, or take a selfie and draw myself from that, whatever. And I was trying to do drawings that I could do every day that wouldn't take very long. And then I can't remember what happened. Because I started, unlike most of my other projects, I started this one quite deliberately, and now I can't remember the starting point, but I started drawing these drawings on A5 Bristol board, which is very smooth paper. I don't know if you use it.
No.
But it means you can do a small drawing and still get a kind of detail in it without being interrupted by the surface of the paper too much, which is nice sometimes, but in this case, I didn't want it. And I kind of thought, instead of drawing myself, I'll ask other people who've got a beard and a bald head to send me their photos. And I said, I just want 100 of these. And I've got more than 100 now, more than 100 photos to work from.
Yeah.
And I've done about 97.
Brilliant.
I just finished one this morning, actually, about 97 of these drawings. And altogether, the idea is that they make a kind of a self-portrait. You know, the idea that every portrait is a self-portrait.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing that I'm perhaps riffing on there. I mean, I never set out as an artist to be a portraitist. But it's a thing that I do now, because sometimes people commission me to do it, so I get paid. And I actually can explore something that's meaningful to me through that same vocabulary, if you like. So yeah, this was another way of doing something meaningful, but individually they look quite nice, and some are better than others. You know, some of the photos are not very good, or some I just wasn't feeling it that day or whatever, but some are really nice and I really like. But what I found is that when I've got them all in a box now, but when I put them all out together, I've been putting them out 10 by 10, or, you know, as close as I can get with the ones that I've got, and looking at them all together, that's one piece of work now. And so I'm not really seeing them as being displayed like in frames separately around the room or anything like that. 'Cause I want to do something with them. I want to exhibit them somehow. But the best way I can think of exhibiting them is in one massive frame.
Nice.
And it would have to be about 2.5 meters high by about 2 meters wide. Nice. To fit them all in.
Yeah.
And that would, I don't know how I'd get that made, but I'm sure that's possible.
It's just wood, isn't it? Wood and glass.
It's just wood and glass, yeah. And some sort of, I guess I don't know how I quite like them as objects, so I don't want them behind those cardboard mats.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I'd want them maybe like just on a backboard of some sort, but they look,
or floating would be
but they look so much more powerful as a piece of art altogether. They've got this sort of cohesion, but also like they have more of the meaning that I kind of was trying to search for in doing the drawings, which is, here's a little snapshot of, looks like a cross section of a particular look, if you like, of people. You know, you walk around, you go around, especially in the city in London, somewhere like that. You look around in the middle of town, you look around and everybody's there. You've got all genders, you've got all ages, all ethnicities, everybody's there, and that's brilliant. And if you can do like a little funny cross section right through that,
yeah. You
can come up with some really interesting things. So for me, doing this one was an obvious one because it's me, it's beard and bald head, and that's quite a neat little way of sub-categorizing a small part of the population. But you could do it in so many ways.
Yeah.
Like, and I quite like to do that again and again and again and do 100.
It'd be like the easiest game of guess who ever, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what will be next, though. I'm sort of open to suggestions, but I don't think I'm going to be doing any more beardy baldies for a while.
What's the reason? I've never thought of why it's mainly men. I mean, occasionally you'd see a lady whose hair's thinning.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny how it's generally men, isn't it? Is it testosterone or?
I think it's got something to do with that. Male pattern baldness has got the word male in it. But actually, I didn't want to have to sort of caveat this. At the beginning, I didn't want it to just be about men. So I did quite specifically say, you know, I don't want to exclude anybody. So if you're a girl and you've got a bald head, for whatever reason, whether that might be to do with like a medical condition like alopecia or something, or whether you know, as part of your style, you shave it all off. But if you're prepared to either grow a beard or pretend, you know, but draw a beard on,
yeah.
I'll include you. But nobody did. I'm sort of a bit disappointed that I didn't get anybody like that.
That would have really pulled out, wouldn't it?
But I mean, that's fine. Nobody responded like that. But
Do you still want one?
Yeah. I'd still cram one in if somebody responded with one.
Gail Porter.
Do you know what? I walked past Gail Porter in the street the other day in Soho. And as I walked past her, I smiled at her because I thought, I recognise that person. But the smile I gave her, you know when you smile at somebody and you give them the wrong smile?
Yeah.
But the smile I gave her was like one of those kind of, it won't come out on a podcast, will it, this, the smile I'm doing?
Yeah.
But it was like a kind of, aww. Yeah, a smile. And that is not the smile I intended. I intended to give her a smile, which was, you're Gail Porter, I think you're awesome, you know, thumbs up or whatever, but it wasn't. Anyway, I Googled her later, and I was like, shit, it was Gail Porter, and now she's going to walk away going, there's another guy who gave me a shitty look and a shitty smile.
Well, I reckon I've got like maybe 10 friends who have all met her, and it just turns out that when I was supposed to have gone to this do, I didn't. And Gail was there with loads of my mates. When there was like someone else's do on and I couldn't make it, Gail was there with. So this group of mates know her.
I did follow her on Instagram almost immediately after I saw her because I thought Instagram's quite a useful thing for just messaging people. And some people, you know that they don't ever read them because they get like a million messages. They're never going to read them. But like, you know that some people, the kind of people who might, and I've always thought that she might be the kind of person who would.
Well, yeah, I reckon she'll be up for that. When was your first interest in art, Jeff?
I think lots of your interviewees will be saying the same thing, that they can't either remember or that it's always been there. My parents were both illustrators and my mum's an artist, if I can sort of distinguish between those two things. So kind of was always surrounded by art and the idea.
In the home, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that it was normal to draw a thing rather than just a thing that kids do, colouring in or whatever. So, and there's always been art materials, there's always been paper around. So, yeah, it's never been an unusual thing. So I guess it's always been there. I mean, there've been times when I've sort of not given it up, but just not nurtured it, you know. But most of the time, yeah, it's been a part of what I do daily.
Did you get the point that you wanted to be an artist?
I don't know what. I was surrounded by people who were artists. So I didn't ever know probably what it actually meant to be an artist. Not until I went to art school and then I got, you know, there were artists coming around and speaking to us, you know, like visiting lecturers and things like that. But that's probably when I got switched off from wanting to be an artist probably, or from thinking that I probably wouldn't ever be one, because the messaging there was pretty much overwhelmingly negative. Like, you know,
I hear that so often on here.
Yeah, what the kind of
the experience of like an art school or interaction with people above, if you like,
yeah,
put you off of being an artist, tutors, or like you say, visiting lecturers, or someone might meet an artist and they're being so negative about the you know, being able to be a practicing artist that it's put people off, and it's a fucking shame because you've wasted, or possibly you could have wasted, several years of your artistic life.
Yeah, I think I did. I think as soon as I finished my undergraduate course, it's funny, I went and saw Ray Richardson's show on Monday.
Oh, brilliant.
I really, really enjoyed that. And he's a great person to chat to. And he said something, I can't remember whether it was on your podcast or not, but about the idea that, you know, not very many people are going to make it as artists. You know, you need something to fall back on. And he was saying that he sort of sat at the back of the lecture theatre and was like, I'm going to be that guy that makes it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was amazing. But I didn't do that. You know, I sat back at the back of the lecture theatre and went, do you know what? I'm fuck it. You know, I can't be asked then. You know, if the odds are so stacked against you and the people who are going to make it are really the ones who've got quite a lot of financial backing. I'm lucky. You know, I come from a background where, you know, my art expression has always been endorsed and has always been facilitated. But my parents were wealthy. So I couldn't, like, take a risk on, like, you know, going and spending a year or two in London being a young artist and seeing if a gallery picked me up. And if they did, I'm off. No, I kind of had to get a job and do all the other things. So, like, I'm not dismissing people who have privilege like that as being not very good artists. So I'm not saying that there's a limited way of becoming an artist. But when you hear that stat being quoted to you about like 3% or whatever it is of people at art school go on to make a living doing art, I think it's a massively problematic thing to bring up, because that person who says that might think what they're doing is giving a dose of realism and smashing some stupid dreams about being an artist. But actually, maybe start telling people about the things that they could do in order to be one of those
3%. Yeah.
You know, like, have the right mindset. You start documenting your work, you know, or these are the kinds of people you need to talk to. This is how you deal with your tax return when you're a self-employed artist.
Yeah.
Here's how to manage having a job and being an artist at the same time.
Yeah, the business side of it, yeah.
Nobody talks about that kind of stuff. I mean, I know people bang on about this all the time, but like, if you're gonna come into an art school and say things like only 3% of you are gonna make it, then you're part of that problem.
Yeah, you're sort of disconnecting from 97% of the fucking people you're talking to.
Yeah, I mean, it's like going, I'm reinforcing the idea that, I say, I don't want to get political, but like a kind of a conservative small C, or maybe even a Tory idea of like the arts being the kind of thing that if they're any good, they'll make money. Therefore, we shouldn't really need to kind of support those kind of arts, which is ridiculous. You know, these things need supporting in order for things to grow and to nurture and to become better. And if you're just going to say, well, you know, 97% of you are just wasting your time here because it's not very worthwhile,
then
it's massively problematic and just feeds into that idea of the arts being a kind of luxury for people to pursue. And that means that people who aren't heiresses or, you know, have got loads of money behind them.
Because I come from, none of my family and friends have ever been to a fucking gallery, you know, let alone into art. And when I said I wanted to do this fine art degree, people are going, oh, you could go into sign writing, or you could be a tattooist.
Yes.
You know, because that's as far as their aesthetic mind can take them, you know. And I was going, that doesn't interest me in the slightest. No disrespects to anyone who does that.
No.
It's fucking fine. But I want to go and I want to see my work up on a gallery wall. I want someone to stand in front of it. And people are going like, but, you know, you won't earn from that. And I said, I don't care. I'm going to have a fucking happy life.
Yeah,
I'm fucking skint at the moment, but I'm fucking happy being in this world.
Yeah, that's a good, that's definitely a good way for people to be taught about art when they're at art school is.
I'm happy to be one of the 97%.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I might even have a jacket made up, you know, like the Hell's Angels have, but they have one percenter on it, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah,
97 percenter.
Yeah, yeah, one of the 97 art school, 97%. Yeah, that's a good idea, because what they should do, instead of saying 3% of you are going to make it, they should say 97% of you are going to be happy, because brilliant, you're going to be making art for your own.
I can write that down, that's good. There you go. Didn't I say you'd like it? That 97% have properly tickled me. I'm going to get some badges made up. If you want one, let me know. There'll just be a couple of quid and the money will go in the pot for the running of the podcast. Perfect. As I said at the start, because it was such a good conversation, I didn't want to edit too much out of it. So the second part of this conversation will be out in 2 days' time. And if you remember at the start of this conversation, Jeff and I were talking about the Samaritans. And I'm sure you'd agree that at moments like this, I'd be irresponsible not to give their phone number out. And it's an easy one to remember, 116 123. And if you're using a phone that isn't yours or you share the bill, the Samaritan's number doesn't appear on it. And most of the time, when you've got a little something bubbling away inside, you don't want to tell a friend or a loved one or someone who's very close. And, you know, the Samaritans have got that bit of disconnect, haven't they, you know? So if it applies to you, 116 123. Sorted. So, as I've already mentioned, part two of this conversation is coming out in just 2 more days. See you then. Like I say every week, on whichever platform you listen to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. If you've got any queries, drop us a line on social media at ministryofarts.org. If you're enjoying these episodes, spread the word of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're not, well, fuck you. You won't be listening to this bit anyway. And those of you that are, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.